his people is in a position of power anymore. The paperback of The End of Men offers a new epilogue. A great deal of the piece antagonizes the feminists Rosin imagines gleefully reveling in the suffering of all us downtrodden women. Rosin implores feminists to accept that the patriarchy is dead, which is so patently absurd that the hashtag RIP Patriarchy quickly flourished on Twitter in response. In the epilogue, she picks a pointless fight with an audience that simply isn't paying her any mind. Rosin is not wrong that life has improved in measurable ways for women, but she is wrong in suggesting that better is good enough. Better is not good enough, and it's a shame that anyone would be willing to settle for so little. I cannot think of clearer evidence of how alive and well the patriarchy remains. See above. It's a shame, really, because the epilogue and its tone do such a disservice to a reasonably good book. There's also blatantly incorrect information, like the suggestion that women compose a third of Congress. Women represent 18.3% of the 535 seats in the 113th Congress. We don't need to get petty, though. The patriarchy, if that's what we're calling it today, is alive and well. The tech industry is consistently embroiled in one misogyny-related controversy or another. At TechCrunch's 2013 Disrupt, two programmers shared the TitStare app, which is exactly what you think it is. Something so puerile is hardly worth anyone's time or energy, but it's one more example of the cultural stupidity that is fueled by misogyny. That same year, Harvard introduced Riptide, a project that will examine how journalism collapsed under the pressure of digital advances. Unfortunately, most of the people interviewed for the project were white men, offering, as usual, a narrow perspective on an issue that would benefit from a more diverse set of voices. Fix the Family, a conservative Catholic family values organization, published a list of reasons why families should not send their daughters to college. The list is not satirical. These are relatively small things, though. Symptoms, not the disease. These situations are irritants that pale in comparison to the more significant issues women face, both in the United States and around the world. We could talk about the retraction of reproductive freedom in North Carolina and Texas and Ohio, or we could conjure up a lot of statistics about domestic and sexual violence, or women living in poverty. If the patriarchy is dead, the numbers have not gotten the memo. Rosin suggests that feminists are holding on to a grudge, that feminists are willfully holding on to this notion of patriarchal dominance, as if we would be unable to function if we weren't suffering. I'm only one feminist, but I'm confident we'd be just fine if all were right with the world. Rosin writes, "The closer women get to real power, the more they cling to the idea that they are powerless. To rejoice about feminist victories these days counts as betrayal." The flaw here is the same as the flaw in The End of Men: an all-or-nothing outlook, and an unwillingness to consider nuance. Some women being empowered does not prove the patriarchy is dead. It proves that some of us are lucky. It is far more important to discuss power than to exhaustively regurgitate the harmful cultural effects of power structures where women are consistently marginalized. We already know the effects. We live them and try to overcome them. But let's talk about power. There are bright, shining stars like Marissa Mayer and the other 20 women who are CEOs of the Fortune 500, a whopping 4%. In the updated epilogue, Rosin blithely references this number as if to say, "Leave me within my delusion. I am busy." We can also talk about how no woman has ever been president of the United States, and how, As of July 2013, there were only 19 women presidents and prime ministers throughout the entire world. In some ways, Rosin, who in the book says she is neither a radical feminist nor anti-feminist, makes a clever rhetorical move. No matter how you respond, she places you in the position of seeming like you do, in fact, have a grudge, that you are holding on to anger and unwilling to see the truth, as she frames it. Disagreement, however, is not anger. Pointing out the many ways in which misogyny persists and harms women is not anger. Conceding the idea that anger is an inappropriate reaction to the injustice women face backs women into an unfair position. Nor does disagreement mean we are blind to the ways in which progress has been made. Feminists are celebrating our victories and acknowledging our privilege when we have it. We're simply refusing to settle. We're refusing to forget how much work there is yet to be done. We're refusing to relish the comforts we have at the expense of the women who are still seeking comfort. In Caitlin Moran's How to Be a Woman, she suggests that, historically speaking, women haven't accomplished much at all, that women have not yet risen. Moran says, even the most ardent feminist historian, male or female, citing Amazons and tribal matriarchies and Cleopatra, can't conceal that women have basically done fuck all for the last 100,000 years. Come on, let's admit it. Let's stop exhaustingly pretending that there is a parallel history of women being victorious and creative on an equal with men that's just been comprehensively covered up by the man. According to Moran, women simply haven't had the chance to achieve greatness the way men have because of a number of socio-cultural factors that have favored male dominance. How to Be a Woman, a memoir-cum-feminist text, also approaches gender matters in a selective manner, one grounded in a narrow brand of feminine experience. This is a book where the main thesis revolves around asking if men are worrying about the things women worry about. It's a catchy idea. One of the most oft-quoted excerpts is, and it's asking this question, are the men doing it? Are the men worrying about this as well? Is this taking up the men's time? Are the men told not to do this, as it's letting our side down? Are the men having to write bloody books about this exasperating, retarded, time-wasting bullshit? Who wouldn't want to be on board with this succinct philosophy? There's so much in this book that demands we reconcile casual insensitivity and narrow cultural awareness for the sake of funny, feminist, albeit dated, thinking. Again, we have to deal with selectivity, because while people love quoting the question, are the men doing it, they ignore what Moran says farther down the page about her stance on burqas. Quote, it was the are the boys doing it basis on which I finally decided I was against women wearing burqas. End quote. This is an odd, glaring statement, because I'm not sure what Moran's stance on burqas has to do with anything. Lori Balbo notes in an article about an Egyptian news anchor choosing to wear the hijab during a newscast, quote, there's no difference between forcing women to wear hijab and forcing them not to wear. The ultimate decision must be that of the individual. End quote. Western opinions on the hijab or burqas are rather irrelevant. We don't get to decide for Muslim women what does or does not oppress them, no matter how highly we think of ourselves. In How to Be a Woman, Moran also says, quote, I want to reclaim the phrase strident feminist in the same way the hip-hop community has reclaimed the word nigger. End quote. This is a baffling statement because there is simply no reality where the phrase strident feminist can be reasonably compared to the N-word. I am fascinated by the silence surrounding this statement, how people will turn a blind eye to casual racism for the sake of funny feminism. For the most part, lavish praise has been heaped on the book. The New York Times raves, "How to Be a Woman is a glorious, timely stand against sexism so ingrained we barely even notice it." More than one review has noted the dearth of humor in feminist texts given. You know, that we love the narrative of feminists as humorless. As such, they are that much more appreciative of the humor in Moran's book. Once again, we can overlook cultural ignorance so long as we're made to laugh. Time and again, Moran undermines her ideas by thinking she should apply her outlook to cultural experiences she knows nothing about. She blithely writes, quote, "All women love babies, just like all women love Manolo Blahnik shoes and George Clooney. Even the ones who wear nothing but sneakers or are lesbians and really hate shoes and George Clooney." End quote. Again, this is funny, but it is also untrue. And to try to generalize about women for the sake of humor dismisses the diversity of women and what we love. Moran undermines herself by privileging feminism as something that can exist in isolation of other considerations. Her feminism exists in a very narrow vacuum, to everyone's detriment. It's a shame because the book could have been so much more if Moran had looked just a bit beyond herself. Given the popularity of How to Be a Woman, I can't help but feel this was a missed opportunity. But then there is writing about gender that is unapologetically sprawling, that reaches both backward and forward and tries to explode the vacuum of cultural conversations. We should start at the end of Heroines, where Kate Zambrino writes, "For my criticism came out of, has always come out of, enormous feeling." What intrigues me most about Zambrino's writing is how it so richly embodies the ethos she espouses. In Heroines, Zambrino has created a hybrid text that is part manifesto, part memoir, and part searing literary criticism. This hybridity is the book's strongest feature, and the way she moves among these different ambitions works very well. Not only does she try to elevate the conversations we have about gender, she leads by example. Her criticism rises from emotion. It is appealing to see a writer so plainly locate the motivations behind her criticism. All too often, criticism is treated rather antiseptically under the auspices of objectivity. There is no such distance in Heroines. Zambrino revels in subjectivity. Zambrino shifts between the personal and the political at a brisk pace, but the narrative style works because it so clearly embodies what Zambrino calls for at the end of the book when she says, "A new sort of subjectivity is developing online. Vulnerable, desirous, well-versed in both pop culture and contemporary writing and our literary ancestors." The nature of the book also rises out of how much of the book comes from her blog, Frances Farmer Is My Sister, where Zambrino chronicles certain aspects of her life and her cultural and critical interests. They say every writer has an obsession, and in Heroines, that obsession is reclamation or, perhaps, breaking new ground where women can be feminist and feminine and can resist the labels and forces that all too often marginalize, silence, or erase female experiences. Zambrino discusses her personal life and romantic relationship, the challenges of acclimating to Akron, Ohio, where she moved with her partner, what it meant to follow her partner, and intersperses these personal observations with examinations of women writers and artists who have in various ways been marginalized, silenced, or erased. Heroines is not a perfect book. There are silences, particularly surrounding race and class, and heterosexual privilege. What does it say when the majority of a woman's heroines are white, heterosexual women? No book can be everything to everyone, but it would have been nice to see what Zambrino, with such electric thinking and writing, would do if she extended her reach, if she exploded the vacuum of cultural conversations even more. I was conflicted about Juno Diaz's collection, This Is How You Lose Her. There is no denying Diaz's talent. The man writes exceptionally well. His stories are vivid and memorable, intelligent and intense. He understands how to work within the short form and brings a real elegance to the structures of his stories. Diaz grounds his writing in a rich cultural context and is able to capture the authenticity of his characters by allowing them to be unapologetically flawed. These 9 interconnected stories follow Junior, his family, the woman he has loved, lost, and scorned, and how in the end he ends up alone, amidst the ruins of his misdeeds. I have been conflicted about this book because I loved these stories. The richness of the details, the voice, the way the stories pull the reader from beginning to end. These are stories with gravity. They hold the reader in place. Otra Vida Otra Vez, about a woman who works as a laundress and is in a relationship with a married man. Junior's father speaks so beautifully to the immigrant experience, to the choices women make in love, to what they tolerate from men, to how closely they hold their hopes. Otra Vida Otra Vez is, without a doubt, one of the finest stories I have ever read. There is indeed something to admire in each story. In Invierno, I could not forget the description of a long, desolate winter when Junior, his brother, and their mother are first brought to the United States. What snow felt like on Junior's bare head. In Miss Laura, Diaz makes it easy to sympathize with both Junior, 16, and mourning the loss of his brother, and Miss Laura, the middle-aged woman he has an affair with. The collection ends with The Cheater's Guide to Love, a story filled with regret and sorrow as Junior details the years after his fiancée breaks up with him because of his serial cheating. The story is naked, intensely confessional, a rending of the self. Junior trying to purge himself of his wrongdoings. Then there is the sexism, which is at times virulent. In an interview with NPR, Diaz says he grew up in a world where I wasn't really encouraged to imagine women as fully human. I was in fact pretty much, by the larger culture, by the local culture, by people around me, by people on TV, encouraged to imagine women as something slightly inferior to men. The influence of that world is plainly apparent throughout This Is How You Lose Her. Women are their bodies and what they can offer men. They are pulled apart for Junior's sexual amusement. There's nothing wrong with that, the fact that Junior is a misogynist of the highest order, that he is a product of a culture that routinely reduces women, that he is unable to remain faithful to his women, that none of the men in this book is very good to women. This is fiction, and if people cannot be flawed in fiction, there's no place left for us to be human. Still, I keep coming back to the relative impunity with which the men in This Is How You Lose Her get to behave badly, and to the tone of the critical reception to these stories, which are not only stories but confessions, lamentations of misdeeds. We have all been influenced by a culture where women are considered inferior to men, and I would have loved to see what a writer of Diaz's caliber might do if he allowed his character to step out of the constraints of the environment he grew up in. one to which readers are all subjected. In response to these limited ways in which we talk, write, and think about gender, these vacuums in which we hold cultural conversations, no matter how good our intentions, no matter how finely crafted our approach, I cannot help but think, this is how we all lose. I'm not sure how we can get better at having these conversations, but I do know we need to overcome our deeply entrenched positions and resistance to nuance. We have to be more interested in making things better than just being right, or interesting, or funny. Reaching for catharsis. Getting fat right or wrong. And Diana Speckler's Skinny. I went to fat camp once, the summer after my sophomore year in high school. I went to fat camp mostly against my will. I thought I was too old to be going to a camp of any kind. I told myself I wasn't really fat enough for fat camp. For the three previous years, however, I had been eating everything in sight. Finally, 40 pounds heavier, people were beginning to notice. My boyfriend made annoying comments about my moderately expanding hips when we were lying on his twin bed at boarding school. One of my classmates said, "Damn, girl," when she noticed an extra shake in my ass. I would come home for holiday breaks, and my parents noticed a new roundness to my figure. They did not approve. They gave me all kinds of advice about exercising self-control and eating properly. "Moderation," my father would say, "is the key to everything." Moderation is pretty much his favorite word. My parents meant well. They worried because I had always been thin, kind of lanky, and then I wasn't. There was an incident with some boys in the woods, and suddenly I was stuffing my face with Twinkies or ordering a pizza late at night, trying to fill this ragged, ugly thing inside me that couldn't be filled or quieted. I ignored my parents and their worry entirely. All I wanted to do was eat. My body grew, became more significant, more noticeable, and more invisible at the same time. Most important, though, the bigger I made my body, the safer I felt. Bad things, I decided years earlier, could not happen to big bodies. I was not necessarily incorrect in my thinking. Eating was, in part, a survival instinct. I was reminded of my stint at fat camp as I read Diana Speckler's Skinny. I mostly read this book because I am not skinny. The novel tells the story of Gray Lachman, a woman in her 20s who runs away to work as a fat camp counselor in North Carolina while grieving her father, who has died. There's a complex history between Gray and her father, from whom she was estranged prior to his death. For tenuous reasons, she blames herself for her father's passing. When she runs away to fat camp in North Carolina, Gray leaves behind a longtime boyfriend in New York, Mikey, a comedian who loves her, and a mother who also has a troubled relationship with food. Despite everything she leaves behind, Gray neglects to abandon her lifelong obsession with her body and being skinny and binge eating. At the fat camp, run by an incompetent group of people who have no business looking after anyone's children, let alone fat campers, Gray has ample opportunity to continue to indulge her unhealthy behaviors. She has ample time to try to satisfy her own ragged hungers. She makes half-hearted attempts to bond with the campers, even though they much prefer the time and attentions of Sheena, the younger, cool counselor. When Gray sees problems with the campers, she tries to bring them to the attention of the camp director, Lewis. Given how woefully unsuited she is to the task of serving as a camp counselor, She does as well as can be expected. Gray isn't that different from most summer camp counselors. There are other things going on in Skinny beyond grief and self-loathing, and Gray trying to regain control over her body. Gray believes she has a half-sister, a camper named Eden, whom Gray found via the internet after she was appointed as the executor of her father's estate and learned that a sum of money was bequeathed to Eden's mother. Gray spends the summer trying to insert herself into Eden's good graces, with little luck because Eden is a teenager, and teenagers are often hard to get close to. Though she has a boyfriend back in New York, Gray also begins a complicated affair with Bennett, the camp's physical trainer, who is not really a physical trainer. None of the camp's staff members, in fact, are at all prepared to fill the roles they've been assigned. But they make do, unless they don't. Bennett is very physically fit, and so Gray's obsession with her body only intensifies as she tries to whittle her body down to nothing but bone. She spends her nights sneaking off to see Bennett, using sex to forget about her exhausting interior monologue. She spends her days trying to make herself beautiful, as if through beauty she will find happiness. Quote, I spent my free periods doing important things. Folding Crest white strips over my teeth, rubbing self-tanner into my breasts, trying on my jeans that were now too big, rolling the waistband down to admire the jut of my hip bones. End quote. The book is almost hypnotic in how intimately we are immersed in Gray's self-absorption. At one point, Bennett and Gray are having a conversation and he says, It's like you're, I don't know, in love with yourself. And she replies, Self-absorption is different from self-love. The camp I attended was nestled in the Berkshire Mountains, on what I was told were beautiful grounds. But beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and beauty I did not behold. I thought the camp was the worst place on earth. I went there for 6 expensive, excruciating weeks. It was hot, and there was no air conditioning. We had to walk everywhere, and there were great distances between all the buildings. The cabins were high on a hill, and when I say hill, what I really mean is mountain. If you wanted to change clothes or lie down for a minute, or if, God forbid, you forgot something in your bunk, you had to scale the Fat Camp Kids version of Everest. It was exhausting, which was, I suppose, the point. We spent a cruel amount of time outdoors, hiking and swimming and being eaten by mosquitoes. The weigh-ins were a humiliating affair where you removed your shoes and stepped on the scale and held your breath as the director kept sliding whatever those things are called back and forth until the scale settled on your weight. If you did well, you were congratulated and encouraged to do better. If you didn't do well, you received a stern lecture and a disappointed look. None of the campers really gave a damn one way or the other because kids at Fat Camp don't care about being really fat or sort of fat or on the verge of fat. Their parents do. Like at most summer camps, in addition to all the exercise and dieting, there were activity nights, and we wrote letters home, and we gossiped and hooked up. You know what I really learned at Fat Camp? I learned how to smoke. I fell madly in love with smoking. I learned how to make myself throw up. I learned how to stand on the edges of the scale to throw my weight off a little. After the younger kids had their curfew, most of the counselors, a motley crew of college students not much older than us, some of whom had once been campers themselves, would gather behind one of the cabins to drink and smoke and make out. When we hovered around their circle, the counselors rarely protested and often encouraged us to join in the fun. There is a certain thrill in corruption, even though, for most of us, our corruptions had started long before we arrived at camp. The first cigarette I ever smoked was a Benson & Hedges menthol. I felt like quite the sophisticate sitting on a log, inhaling deeply, exhaling slowly, pretending I had been smoking for years. The habit would stay with me for the next 18 years. So in some ways, Fat Camp had a very lasting effect. It makes perfect sense that many of us obsess over our bodies. There is nothing more inescapable. Our bodies move us through our lives. They bring pleasure and pain. Sometimes our bodies serve us well, and other times our bodies become terribly inconvenient. There are times when our bodies betray us, or our bodies are betrayed by others. I think about my body all the time. How it looks, how it feels, how I can make it smaller, what I should put into it, what I am putting into it, what has been done to it, what I do to it, what I let others do to it. This bodily preoccupation is exhausting. There is no one more self-absorbed than a fat person, and skinny exposes just how obsessive people are when they are unhappy with their bodies. This is not to say all fat people are unhappy with their bodies, but many are. Most of my friends are equally obsessive even though they are thin. Hating themselves or specific parts of themselves, their arms, their thighs, their chins, their ankles. They do crazy diets and starve themselves and run themselves ragged trying to maintain some semblance of control over things that are somewhat out of our control. I don't think I know any woman who doesn't hate herself and her body at least a little bit. Bodily obsession is, perhaps, a human condition because of its inescapability. Skinny speaks well to how inescapable our bodies really are and how easy it is to lose control. As the summer progresses, gray becomes, for all intents and purposes, anorexic. What starts as a desire to lose excess weight becomes a singular focus. She takes to eating nothing and exercising all the time, running, doing aerobics, pushing herself to extremes, reveling in the dramatic way her body changes, with jutting bones everywhere and loose clothing and the airy high of starvation. When Gray is having sex with Bennett, she marvels at how athletic and fit they both are and how their bodies fit together. I would straddle him, kneeling, holding the handles of his ears, or I would lean all the way back, my spine arched, my hair spreading over his feet, or I would lie supine as he knelt above me, his legs as sturdy as Corinthian columns, my head hanging off the edge of the bed, a heel on each of his shoulders. Gray drowns herself in her affair with Bennett, so she can avoid confronting herself or her grief. Their relationship is born primarily of opportunity. Gray thinks about her boyfriend, Mikey, occasionally, but shows little remorse for how she betrays the man who loves her and how she betrays herself. She is grieving, after all. And in grief, there is a certain amount of indulgence for bad behavior. Sorrow allows us a freedom happiness does not. As Gray's body thins, the writing soars with euphoria, almost as if the writer herself feels freer. I enjoyed Skinny because it reminded me of the misery of Fat Camp, and because it's rare to read well-written fiction about matters of size. At the same time, I struggled with this book. It was hard to take Gray seriously because she clearly wasn't that overweight. The body is a personal territory, and every person's weight struggle should be taken seriously. But there's overweight and there's overweight. If you're the latter, it is difficult to take the former seriously, right or wrong. No one who shops at Lane Bryant or the Avenue, or Catherine's, is going to feel empathy for someone who is 30 pounds overweight. It's not going to happen. There are two significant weaknesses with this book, and the way 30 pounds of excess weight is treated like it is 300 pounds of excess weight is one of them. It can be hard, at times, to separate the writer from the writing. I didn't know anything about Diana Speckler prior to reading Skinny. After reading the book, I used Google's image search to see if she was fat. I was curious to see if she wrote from experience or if she was writing what she imagined to be the interior life of a fat person. I have to believe I am not the only one who did this. I know better. I do. But I couldn't help myself. Photographic evidence reveals that Diana Speckler is a gorgeous, thin woman with long hair. She may not have always been this way. Her appearance does not matter, but it does. It matters because we're talking about bodies and fat and the petty betrayals of the flesh. In graduate school, a classmate said she took a book about race more seriously when she learned a white woman wrote the book. I wanted to slam that woman's face into the table because it offended me to my core that she thought a white woman deserved more respect and held more authority for broaching complex issues of race. I thought of that day with a tiny bit more understanding as I read Skinny and was willing to take the book more seriously if it had been written by a really fat woman. Someone corpulent, wallowing in rolls of flesh. Someone who would truly know what being fat is like. The overwhelming omnipresence of it. And be able to write that experience authentically. I wanted a lot from this book and its writer. I chose to ignore the ways in which I know better. In Skinny, Gray has gained the 30 pounds that distress her so much because her father is dead. There's more to the story, but the most immediate explanation for Gray's weight concerns is grief. When it comes to fat, there has to be a reason. We need to be able to trace the genealogy of obesity. Without that genealogy, we are simply mystified. People need an explanation for how a person can lose such control over her body. They want to know if you come from a fat family, or if you have some kind of medical condition, or if you are simply weak and really love food that much. In Skinny, we see some of the genealogy of Gray's fat, but perhaps not enough for the story to feel as credible as it should. I watch all the televised fat-shaming porn as penance and motivation. The Biggest Loser and Ruby and Heavy, some of those off-brand fat people shows on lesser cable channels, and recently Extreme Makeover Fat People Edition. It is perversely thrilling to see the gorgeous, perfectly fit trainers yelling at and shaming the fat contestants until their vocal cords bleed, shaming the fat people into working out for 8 hours a day while consuming only 1,200 calories so the fat people can become an instantly gratificatory success story, however temporary that success might be. At some point in each episode, the trainers or the producers will get shallowly psychological with the contestants, trying to figure out why the contestants weigh 280 pounds, 357 pounds, or nearly 600 pounds, trying to uncover the fat genealogy as if all it takes to solve a weight problem is a tearful, heartfelt conversation about what went wrong or who did wrong and when and why. There are dead husbands and dead babies and divorced parents and absent fathers and terrible abuse and all the painful things that happen to a person and the body over the course of a lifetime. The kinds of things that can be appeased or at least numbed in part by a quart of cold ice cream or the hot melted cheese of a pizza. Sometimes the contestants say, "I don't know how I got this way." But they do. There's always a reason. Jillian Michaels, one of the Biggest Loser trainers, loves to force her contestants into dramatic catharsis. it makes for good television. In Skinny, you get the sense that Gray is reaching for catharsis too. She's pushing herself in every way she possibly can to reach some kind of emotional breakthrough. I'm not sure she ever quite finds it. Sometimes, a bold, sort of callous person will ask me how I got so fat. They want to know the why. "You're so smart," they say, as if stupidity is the only explanation for obesity. And of course there's that bit about having such a pretty face. What a shame it is to waste it. I never know what to tell these people. There is the truth, certainly. This thing happened, and then this other thing happened, and it was terrible, and I knew I didn't want either of those things to happen again, and eating felt safe. French fries are delicious, and I'm naturally lazy, too, so that didn't help. I never know what I'm supposed to say, so I mostly say nothing. I don't share my catharsis with these inquisitors. Throughout Skinny, Gray writes letters to fat people. These letters, which the campers also have to write, are an opportunity for soul-searching and truth-telling and all that. Anyone who has spent time in therapy is familiar with the tool of letter writing as a step toward healing. Fat is about the mind more than it is about the body, isn't it? Lewis, the camp director, wants the campers to write these letters to fat people to explain why they hate fat people. "You all hate fat people," Lewis declares. "These letters are the first step," he says, "to help the campers accept their bodies and begin to change their bodies." The letters are full of the cruelties, or truths, everyone thinks about fat people. For example, Gray writes, "Excuses are worthless. Either change your life, stop slinging blame, stop stuffing food into the cracks in your heart, or give yourself over to the shortened, uncomfortable, sweaty life of the obese." These letters are clearly supposed to add something to the narrative. They are deliberate, didactic moments. They get the job done in that you can't help but have a reaction. But the novel would have worked just as well, or even better, without these interludes. So you have to wonder why they were included. The letters are somewhat forced, like those shallowly psychological moments in extreme weight loss television programming, as if the letters are intended as opportunities for the reader to reach a cathartic place too, for the reader to nod and say, "Yes, I think these things about fat people too," so they might ultimately reach a place of empathy and understanding. At times, these letters feel hollow and indulgent because they seem to be written by a skinny person, imagining only one possible existence for a fat person. Imagining that the fat life is somehow markedly different from the skinny life. It is, but it isn't. Save that the wardrobe of the skinny is generally better, and the people around you are generally kinder. There's a letter where Gray writes, "Dear fat people, I see you in motorized wheelchairs, in bus seats that don't accommodate you. I see you taking breaks when you walk, pretending to admire the scenery. I recognize what's going on in that letter. I'm fat, but I have eyes and I judge people too. The other day I was in a clothing store and there were three very fat people on motorized carts congregating near the cash register, laughing merrily. And I thought, how can they be so happy when they are immobile? Then I felt guilty. I considered all the terrible things people must think when they judge me." We're all complicit in these matters, and these letters function in part to remind us of that complicity. It's not that I expected these letters or even this novel to address the full spectrum of the fat experience. Is that even a thing? It's more that the letters speak to the lowest common denominator, nothing more. It's disappointing that Gray cannot possibly imagine that perhaps some fat people have amazing athletic sex, just like she does. Perhaps they aren't sitting around miserably stuffing their faces next to someone who doesn't love them. Earlier, I noted that there were two weaknesses in this book: the implausibility of all this drama over a mere 30 pounds of excess weight, and, of course, these dear fat people letters. Really, though, these issues are symptoms of the same weakness. It's as if the author's understanding of fat people is such that the fattest she could imagine Gray, as still desirable and interesting to Mikey, to Bennett, to the reader, is with only 30 pounds of excess weight. This book would have been stunningly improved if Gray were 100 pounds overweight, maybe more. But I got the sense that the writer was afraid to go there. The Dear Fat People letters are purportedly from Gray, but as the book goes on, you get the impression they are actually from the author herself, confessing her sins, reaching for catharsis from within her own personal prejudices about fat. By the end of Skinny, everything has fallen apart. The camp is shut down. The campers return to their lives, skinnier, certainly, but only by happenstance. They haven't confronted their issues or learned about healthy eating and healthy ways of dealing with difficult circumstances. They haven't acquired the tools to prevent their bodies from further expanding. Bennett returns to his home, and Gray returns to New York, though not to her relationship with Mikey. She regains most of the weight she lost. The ending is a bit rushed, so it's hard to know if Gray has learned much of anything. At the end, Gray is sitting in an empty room with Bennett. There is a new distance between them, even though he does not know it yet. Quote, "And for just a second, I forgot where I was. I forgot the things I always wished to forget. And I felt a remarkable lightness." End quote. We are led to believe something profound has happened in this moment, but the moment is not convincing. In the last Dear Fat People letter, Gray writes, "You wonder why we hate you? You are the visible manifestation of the parts of ourselves we hide." There is truth in that, too. Fat people wear their shit on the outside, with sagging breasts and swollen ankles and heavy thighs. Unlike a heroin addict who might be able to cover track marks with long sleeves, a fat person cannot hide the fact that something has gone awry. Fat people have secrets, and you may not know what those secrets are, but they can be plainly seen. By the end of Skinny, we know many of Gray's secrets, but we don't seem to know or see the secrets that matter. When I left Fat Camp, I had lost the weight I needed to lose, mostly because the food at camp was terrible and there was so much walking. Anyone can lose weight if her only culinary options are Jell-O and salad with light dressing and grilled chicken breasts, and she's never given a minute to sit and relax. In the first few weeks after Fat Camp, it was fun to feel like myself again, to feel light and somehow freed. When I returned to school, there were compliments and other expressions of appreciation for my much thinner body. That felt good, too. But then I started eating again. Worked even harder to make my body fill as much space as possible. Tried to fill that ragged need inside of me. Very little had changed. I had not really found catharsis. Oh, how I hungered. The Smooth Surfaces of Idle. Happiness is not a popular subject in literary fiction. We struggle as writers to make happiness, contentment, and satisfaction interesting. Perfection often lacks texture. What do we say about that smooth surface of idle? How do we find something for narrative to hold on to? Or perhaps we fail to see how happiness can have texture and complexity, so we write about unhappiness. That at least seems easier for me. I am probably too comfortable going there, wallowing in darkness, suffering, unhappiness. Misery loves company. In fiction, we can be unhappy together. I have been thinking about happy endings. I am always thinking about happy endings. I am always thinking about happiness. During an interview, I was asked if I ever write happy stories or happy endings. I considered that question for days. I hear it a lot from people I'm close to as well. Almost every story I write is a happy story, a fairy tale of some kind. Yes, you'll find death and loss and betrayal and darkness and violence in my stories. But there's often also a happy ending. Sometimes people are unable to recognize happiness because all they see is the darkness. I look at many of my stories and I see a woman who has found some kind of salvation after enduring seemingly unsalvageable circumstances. A hero who helps her to that place of peace, however incomplete that peace might be. The details change, but that underlying structure, that fairy tale, is often there. I'm as intrigued by happy endings as I am by the deeply flawed ways people treat one another, even if I don't quite know what to do with that behavior. Fairy tales have happy endings. There are often lessons to be learned, and sometimes those lessons are learned the hard way. But in the end, there is happiness. At least in the fairy tales I like best. My novel, An Untamed State, is in its own way about fairy tales. The story follows a woman who was living a fairy tale, and then she is kidnapped, and her fairy tale ends. Every story can usually be broken down to what it's really about in one sentence. I thought it would be interesting to start with the happy ending and see how that might unravel. It didn't just unravel. In the novel, Muriel Duval's happy ending comes all the way apart, and then I had to figure out how to put the pieces back together, how to get my characters back to something resembling happiness. I really enjoyed writing An Untamed State. I learned so much about pushing myself to write the same project every day and how to tell a story in long form and how to really slow the story down and give it the room it needs. The first draft of An Untamed State did not have a happy ending, but I received feedback indicating a happy ending of some kind, however imperfect, was needed to make things seem less hopeless. I tried my best. As I started thinking about the next novel, one that's about motherhood and surrogacy and a marriage of convenience and the incomplete choices we make when we're too young to know we're doing the wrong thing, I decided that no matter what, no matter how implausible it might seem, this book was going to have a very happy ending. I have no idea how I'm going to get there in a way that doesn't defy credulity. But I am going to try. Maybe it won't be completely realistic, and maybe that's okay. Realism is relative. My fantasy life often feels quite real. Contemporary art often unites the real and the fantastic. Contemporary art inspires, often because it is so difficult to explain or contextualize. In 2011, I saw the brilliantly curated exhibit, Hard Truths, at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, featuring the artwork of Thornton Dial. It's hard to define Dial's style. He works across many mediums, sculpture, drawings, assemblages, collage, much of it socially conscious, all of it gorgeous, passionate, visceral. Born in 1928, Dial grew up in the rural South and endured a great deal of economic hardship. He began working full-time at the age of 7. He experienced a great deal of racism, the untenable burden of segregation. The indelible mark of racism can be seen throughout much of his work. Torment, anger, sadness, pain are all palpable. Unhappiness as muse is not solely the purview of writers. The scale of Dial's art is often imposing. Most of his pieces are massive, taking up entire walls or floors, like he needs that much room to best express himself. My, and how he does. The scale of the art really reinforces the scale of the dark emotional influence. That scale certainly made me feel grateful art exists as an outlet. Trophies, Doll Factory, is one of the first pieces in the Hard Truths exhibit. Women raised Thornton Dial, and their feminine influence marks a great deal of his art. In Trophies, the dolls are garishly painted, half-dressed, many of them painted gold, like Trophies. It's an interesting commentary on modern womanhood, perhaps even more interesting given that the commentary comes from a man. There is so much to look at in Trophies in all of Dial's pieces. The level of detail is remarkable. I would have been content standing in only one of the many rooms of the exhibit, because there was that much to see. The way the dolls are splayed across the canvas, how their breasts are bared, legs spread amid the chaos of the rest of the assemblage, really sets the tone for the exhibit. As I moved on, I thought, there won't be any happy stories here. Dial imbues his work with suffering. The companion volume to the Hard Truths exhibit, edited by Joanne Cubs and Eugene W. Metcalf, details how Dial's art functions as social commentary on race, class, gender, war, politics, all human concerns. In 1993, Dial was interviewed by Morley Safer for 60 Minutes. He thought the interview was going to be about his art, but instead, Safer took the opportunity to do an exposé on how Southern black vernacular artists were being exploited by white art dealers. Dial was and felt ambushed and misled and misrepresented by Safer. He carried a lot of anger about the incident for years, anger you can see in Strange Fruit, Channel 42. Dial's work really gave me the opportunity to think about art as a narrative. In Strange Fruit, Channel 42, you see Dial as the man hanging in effigy, self as strange fruit. And the TV antenna, Channel 42 was the station that aired the Safer interview, where Dial lived. There are smaller details you can't see unless you are standing in front of the piece, but they all work in concert to tell the story of Dial's anger and frustration. He was angry for many reasons, but mostly because he thought the 60 Minutes interview was going to be his big break. That finally his work was going to be recognized. There's a bitter humor to the piece that holds the weight of the artist's disappointment. Dial also created another piece in response to the interview. This one, Looking Good for the Price, is much darker and angrier. A slave auction scene with a macabre white auctioneer. Everything abstract and quite tortured. The images spread across the canvas at awkward angles. Looking Good for the Price tells another story about the artist's anger, his sense of humiliation, another story about unhappiness, one without a happy ending. The exhibit as a whole was overwhelming. As I moved from room to room, I thought about how much pain Dial bleeds onto his canvas, and how he works with that pain in culturally savvy and responsive ways. Given Dial's life story, it's understandable that his work is a reflection of the difficulties he has experienced. I could not imagine that a happy ending would be possible. And yet, room after room of the exhibit was filled with these massive art pieces, sculptures, drawings, most of them created using found materials and lived experiences. The last room of the exhibit, though, was saturated in bright color. It was startling to enter the room and see redemption. salvation, triumph, hope, happiness, a happy ending after a long, sorrowful journey.